The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Dot org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As schools across the country struggle to adapt curriculum to meet the new National Common Core standards, one controversial aspect of education is not included: sex education. Depending on your age, you may have been introduced to the mysteries of sex through nature-inspired metaphors that do little to enlighten students on the reality or outcomes of sexual activity. Or the focus may have been a purely biological discussion about human sex organs. The question of how or even whether to instruct students about sex has been a contentious subject in the U.S. since the 20th century. And as our next guest discovered, the debate rages on worldwide. Jonathan Zimmerman is professor of education and history at New York University and author of a new book that investigates sex education called Too Hot to Handle: A Global History of Sex Education. And Professor Zimmerman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So when and why did schools start teaching kids about sex?
Well, schools started teaching kids about sex first in the United States, which is important, in the early 20th century amidst big venereal disease outbreaks in places like New York and Chicago. Put plainly, middle-class men were patronizing prostitutes, which has always been a major conduit of STDs, and going home and infecting their wives. And this created great panic across our cities and a demand to teach kids in schools, adolescents, sexual continence. To be clear, there were VD outbreaks in places like Paris and Berlin as well during the same years. But what's interesting is that in those cities and societies, the solutions at that time tended to be more legal ones, having to do with the regulation and restriction of prostitution. But Americans, to address this shared problem, seized distinctively on an educational solution.
And what was the educational solution like? What was contained in the instruction?
Well, at the time, it relied heavily on plant and animal metaphors. Teach kids about the pollination of flowers and how rabbits reproduce. And the reason for that was actually quite simple. We wanted to teach kids about sex and especially the dangers of human sexuality outside of marriage without increasing their interest in it. You know, so much of school, especially modern so-called progressive education, is built around the idea of engaging kids' interests and engaging them in activity. What's different and ironic about sex ed, of course, is you're trying to quell their interest and prevent activity.
Right. This is often the argument, right?
Right. And so as a way to try to ward off that claim and to teach without sparking interest, in the early 20th century, we use metaphors from the animal and plant world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've continued to hear that argument about sex education. Are those same arguments against sex education those that are fought globally?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, they have been really since the 1950s and 1960s, with a big spike in the 1980s and 90s because of the HIV epidemic. AIDS changed everything in this world, and unsurprisingly, it changed sex ed, because before AIDS, some people were for sex ed and other people were against it. The people who were against it made arguments like, it's a family matter, it's a matter of parental rights, the school shouldn't intervene in the family, and so on. What you see after HIV is that mostly that argument goes away. HIV created so much turmoil, so much panic, and so much suffering that everybody became for sex ed. They just became for different kinds of sex ed. So in the United States, something developed called abstinence-only education. It's important to note that something like abstinence-only education, while it may seem retrograde to some listeners, was in fact a huge step for conservatives in this country and in other places because it acknowledged that the school had a role in teaching about sex,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which prior to AIDS, many conservatives said it didn't.
Well, this is what's interesting watching in your book, this kind of swinging pendulum between sex education as a safety and survival issue and a moral issue, or something, let's say, purely biological to something more nuanced. Where are we now?
Well, you know, I would say that one of the takeaways from the book is the search for a, quote, purely biological sex ed is essentially a fool's errand, because one of the things we know about sex is, to use a loaded adverb, it is intimately tied to human value and faith systems. I would say that even the claim that sex ed should be only about biology is itself a heavily value-laden statement. So sex ed takes many forms around the world, but I think it's fair to say that in most parts of the world, the value that's taught is keep this activity inside marriage and exclude it from non-marital situations. Mm-hmm. That, too, is a value statement, and I think that's the most common one that's taught via sex ed.
Even though the message is that any kid, you know, looking at the internet, not even for pornography, can witness plenty of other examples of sexuality.
That's exactly right. And for 100 years, in this country and elsewhere, sex educators have tried to use schools to counter messages that come from screens, that come from the media. That, too, is a Sisyphean task. Obviously, there's a lot of very troubling stuff on the media in the past and in the present about sex, and I don't begrudge any school for trying to counter it. But I think there's a huge amount of evidence that in the past and in the present, kids in our country and elsewhere get most of their sexual messages from their peers and from the mass media, not from schools.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jonathan Zimmerman. He's a professor of education and history at NYU. He's out with a new book called Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education. And you do, in your book, make a big distinction between Western and non-Western or developing nations and approaches to sexuality. Often the narrative we have here in the U.S. is that we don't censor violence, but we censor sex, you know, whereas someplace like Sweden is the opposite. How do we stack up there?
Yes. Well, you know, one of the other stories I tell in the book is that although the U.S. was early in the game, very much of a pioneer, the American model, which was one of control and controlling negative outcomes, did come under challenge after the Second World War from continental Europe, especially, as you mentioned, Sweden, which was the first country to require sex ed nationally. They're very proud of that. The founder of sex ed in Sweden is on postage stamps and sculptures, you know, all over the country. But the Swedish model was much more focused on the individual and helping an individual develop a healthy sexuality. And I find that contrast fascinating because I think it also contrasts with many other transatlantic comparisons we make, where we say the United States is all about the individual, but in these European social democracies, they're much more about the collectivity, mm-hmm. about the whole. Mm-hmm. I would say in the sex ed realm, it's quite the opposite from that. And U.S. sex ed began and continues, I think, to emphasize the collective health. And in places like Sweden, it's much more oriented towards the individual.
Well, that's a very, you know, culturally influenced kind of approach. And I'm wondering about the teachers themselves, the educators. How are they trained to best present sex education to children?
Well, you know, one of the many, many myths that we have about Sweden is that everyone's on the same page there. They never have been. It turns out that in Sweden, after they instituted this new sex ed curriculum, that there was all kinds of resistance on the part of the teachers, and there continues to be. They didn't receive very good preparation for doing it. And also, they felt like it was an embarrassing subject and that teaching it would undermine their own authority as teachers. It's embarrassing for many reasons, but one of them is that it addresses the teacher's own sexuality, mm-hmm. at least indirectly, right? The teacher's a sexual being. So when the teacher is enjoined to teach sex ed, at directly or indirectly, the teacher's sexuality is going to come into play. And so for female teachers, this proved to be a very difficult dilemma. Either you were an old maid who wasn't experienced enough, or you were kind of a young hussy who was too interested and too experienced. Wow. How do you walk that line as a female teacher? It's quite difficult.
Well, and Sweden is one place, but in the developing world, you point out that a number of teachers, you know, it was an education for them to learn about sex ed, especially in places where sexuality is so taboo.
Hugely so. And again, especially for women teachers, you know, who often told researchers that, you know, in my country, a woman who talks about sex is a prostitute. And so I can't be associated with that by talking about this subject. So I think there were and continue to be enormous taboos, and the subject puts a huge amount of pressure on teachers who often have very little cultural authority themselves, and who, especially in the developing world, have a myriad of other, you know, near to impossible tasks, you know, teaching 50 or 60 kids of different ages in one room. The other, I think, really important historical factor to keep in mind that's cognate to this discussion is the post-war era is also the first era that schools themselves at the adolescent level become sexual spaces because girls go to school.
Right.
Right? Uh-huh. Of course, they did before, but not in such huge numbers. I think the really important story of the past 50 years is that schools as formal institutions became universal in the world. When I was born, you know, around 1960, only half of human beings stepped into a school during their lifetime, and now upwards of 95% do.
Well, there's clearly no international consensus on how sex education should be taught, even from school to school. But is there any kind of national standard for sex education in the United States?
There isn't. The United States has 14,000 school districts. You know, that's one of the things that makes it both so fascinating and so perilous to study American education like I do, you know. And ever since I wrote this book, I've gotten fascinating emails from people that tell me I've got the story all wrong because they experienced something different.
Mm-hmm.
And surely sex ed in Brookline, Massachusetts is going to look very different from sex ed in Lubbock, Texas. I mean, I say that without knowing what it looks like in either places, but either of those two places, but I do know those communities are very different. But I would also say that it's fair to assume that even within those communities, there's going to be variation because Americans are so transient. You know, we're constantly moving. So to get back to your question, is there a national curriculum or a set of national messages taught about sex that there isn't in our country? The first reason is that education remains primarily a local affair, a locally governed, locally constituted affair. And the second reason is that we're so diverse even within those localities.
Mm-hmm. Any kind of successful models for teaching students about sex now that you found in your research and that could be backed up by some data?
Well, it's an interesting question because obviously it hinges on what you mean by success, right? And in the United States, the way that we've historically measured that has to do with, again, trying to control these negative outcomes.
Mm-hmm. So teenage pregnancies, that kind
right.
of thing.
Does STDs. It reduce teenage pregnancy? Does it reduce teenage STDs? And I think it's fair to say that the research based on that question is extremely small because sex ed is so haphazard and brief. If a kid in high school gets a total of 5 to 10 hours of sex ed throughout high school, showing that 5 or 10 hours actually affected the kid's sexual decision-making is a hugely difficult thing. We have some little glimmers that certain programs have had success, but I think it's fair to call them glimmers. And that's why in this debate, if you hear anybody on any side of the political spectrum make a blanket statement with huge certitude that sex ed does X behaviorally, either on the right, you know, it makes people have more sex, or on the left, it makes them behave in more sexually responsible ways, use contraception, et cetera, you can pretty much write them off as an ideologue. Because, you know, if something's happening that rarely, to claim that it's having such a strong and observable behavioral effect, it's not really a plausible claim. I would say that if you're defining success in these behavioral terms, it's really hard to measure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an important if because, you know, in a country like Sweden, one of the things I discovered was that wasn't the measure of success. The measure of success was, you know, are kids leading a healthy and pleasurable sexual life? And that goes way beyond the question of these negative outcomes. It's also quite difficult to determine, but it's a different goal.
Well, right. No clear answers for a complicated issue. And Jonathan Zimmerman, thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman is a professor of education and history at NYU and author of a new book that looks at how sex education has changed over the years and what's going on with it globally. Too Hot to Handle is the title, A Global History of Sex Education. And you can find more in the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, I spoke with Professor Jonathan Zimmerman about how schools approach sex education, both globally and locally. In the U.S., sex ed can vary wildly depending on your age, your home state, and where you went to school. We even found some striking disparities among the word-of-mouth team.
I don't remember a lot about sex ed in school, but I remember one specific moment, and I think I was in fifth grade, and it was in the wake of Ryan White, and it was when Ryan White had been diagnosed with AIDS, and they weren't allowing him to go to school, and there was a lot of fear behind that. And the lesson that I remember is that our teacher came in, she was a science teacher, and she put down a beaker of liquid. She told us that for us to get AIDS from saliva, we would have to drink that amount of liquid. And I just remember all of us being stunned into silence, like, oh my gosh, that's disgusting. Like, that's so much saliva.
So I remember very little except that our science teacher, Mr. Hartnett, he was also, I think, the hockey coach at Runlet Junior High, but this was at Conant School. But all I remember was being mixed in this classroom of boys and girls and uteruses on overhead projectors, and I was profoundly embarrassed that this conversation, which was really purely biological, was taking place in mixed company because I knew what it was about more than I knew what was being communicated.
So I don't remember like the official sex ed, but I lived in England for a year when I was a kid. I was like 10. And there was this period of time where we must have done some sort of like reproductive unit because they offered a bunch of books that were about like reproductive biology. And there was this one book, and it was about sex, and it was illustrated with these like really goofy sort of like balloon-like people, like their bodies were just like one big circle and they had like stick legs and arms. And there was these series of illustrations showing these people having sex in all these really weird settings. Like one of them, they're having sex on a skateboard and they're like holding balloons. And I remember just being so confused because how could you do something like that on a skateboard?
I went to Leominster High in Massachusetts, in Central Mass, and we had a health course. And as part of that health course, there was sex ed. And my sex ed teacher was also my cross-country coach. We'd already sort of gone through the curriculum, you know, where you see the diagrams and this and that, but it was that part of the course where you're supposed to have the discussion and kind of, you know, rap about sex issues, peer pressure, and things like this. I was in the ninth grade. I was sitting next to my friend Angela, and my teacher, you can bleep out his name if you want, Mr. comes into the classroom and then brings out a boombox, hands out papers, a questionnaire to everyone, and then hits play.
And it was?
Meatloaf, Paradise by the Dashboard Light. And so instead of engaging the students in a conversation, he decided that he would let Meatloaf do the talking for him. And I never had a girl looking any better than you did. Keep in mind, this was 1993.
And then that must have been made in the mid-70s, the Meatloaf record, right?
I think it was 77, 2 years before any of the students in that class were born.
Oh, so it was his filter of sex ed, I guess,
so
not really focused on you.
No. But at that point, I'm in the ninth grade. We were listening to Dr. Dre. I think Rex and Effects' Rump Shaker was at the top of the charts, like filthy, dirty songs. And he was thinking, Meatloaf is going to blow the, it's going to blow your mind. He's really cutting edge. We're going to go all the way tonight. We're going to go all the way tonight, tonight. We're going to go all the way tonight. And then there's that part. I'm seriously getting chills right now just thinking of it. I'm so embarrassed. Where there's are kind of like the sexy sounds. Ugh. And it's a very long song, as I discovered, as we all had to sit there uncomfortably in Mr.'s class listening to it.
There's the wind-up, and there it is, a line shot up the middle. Look at him go, this boy gets really...
And the questionnaire, as you went through it, said, you know, what do you think the baseball signifies. What does paradise mean? What is? And I remember just giggling with my friend Angela, and we put sex down for every single one. We were like, six. We think it means sex.
Batter steps up to the plate. Here's the pitch, and he's going, and what a jump he's got. He's trying to third.
And then I think at the end of the song, it is a home run. The baseball player makes it to home. So what kind of message is that?
Holy cow, I think he's going to make it.
Stop right there. I got to know right now.
So, Maureen, what do you think you learned that day?
I learned that baseball can sometimes mean sex. that's about it. So that was... That's how I learned about the birds and the bees.
That's our senior producer, Maureen McMurray, reminiscing on her school's musical approach to sex education.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Wrongful convictions can be the result of many things. Improper forensics, forced confessions, inadequate defense, all make it high on the list. But the number one contributing factor to convicting the wrong person is something that fails us every day, human memory. Eyewitness testimonies often set criminal cases on a judicial fast track. Research shows that these accounts are fallible, and advocates say it's time to review the process, especially since 75% of the wrongful convictions cases exonerated in America last year involved testimony from faulty eyewitnesses. Charlotte Silver looked into the accuracy of eyewitness testimonies for Vice magazine and found that misidentifications have long been a central player in wrongful convictions. Charlotte, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You tell the story of just a remarkably, almost comically botched robbery in Orange County, California, back in 1998. Three robbers, one of whom driving a getaway car, walks across the street to talk to a shop mechanic about getting a new engine for his car. But nonetheless, two witnesses identify a guy named Guy Miles. He's got a record, and they say he's one of the robbery suspects. They identify him from what you call a six-pack of mugshots. Now, what's a six-pack?
So six-packs are sort of the traditional way that police departments conduct these photo lineups, and it's six mugshots on one piece of paper so that the witness can review them all at once and decide who of the six most closely resembles the perpetrator. And the idea of a six-pack came from actually the understanding that the process of being shown a picture of a possible suspect would immediately influence a witness. So instead of a police saying, okay, here's our suspect, is that the person you saw? They do a six-pack to sort of try to diffuse that sort of presumption of guilt. But in fact, what it does is sort of encourage witnesses to, instead of testing each photo to their own memory, they test each photo to the other photos on the six-pack. So they're comparing photo one to photo three, and they're picking the one that most closely resembles the memory, as opposed to just saying, okay, are any of these people actually the perpetrators? And it encourages the witness to pick someone, even if no one in the photo lineup is actually guilty.
So how did the six-pack work against Guy Miles in particular during the investigation?
So Guy Miles was actually living in Las Vegas at the time of the robbery. He's from Carson, California, which is about 30 minutes away from Fullerton. He had a past with crime, and he had left Carson to try to sort of start a new life in Las Vegas. And he was in violation of his parole at the time, so he hadn't informed the authorities or his parole officer where he was living. So according to them, that he was still in Southern California. So when he entered into the photo lineup, the two witnesses who had been robbed at the bank, he was one of many they had selected as maybe possibly looking like one of the men who held them up. And this was a holdup that included a gun, it included violence, it included a lot of factors that would compromise anyone's memory. you know, the sort of when someone's frightened in a crime scene, their memory is immediately compromised. And these are the factors that reform advocates want juries to be made aware of. So the witnesses had identified several possible suspects among the 48 mugshots they were shown. Guy Miles was in the very last six pack, and he was the one that they both agreed on resembled a man that was held up, and the police took it and went with it.
Mm-hmm. And he represented the guy that they said was shorter, stockier. And
right.
he was eventually convicted, and that was his third strike, so he is doing 75 years to life. How common are misidentifications in cases of wrongful convictions?
Well, we can't know because all we can sort of assess is who has been exonerated at this point. But as you said in your introduction, 75% of exonerations, those cases involved a misidentification. And an eyewitness testimony at a trial is extremely convincing. And if the jury is not presented with sort of mediating factors, the eyewitness testimony may be compromised for various reasons, whether it was raining, whether they saw it through a window, whether it was 9 o'clock at night, whether there was a gun involved, all of these factors, this should be presented to a jury so they can put into context an eyewitness's testimony.
Mm-hmm. You also found that a third of the people identified as perpetrator from a police photo lineup, one in three is one of those fillers that they just put there to fool people.
Right.
We're speaking with journalist Charlotte Silver, who wrote an article on the fallibility of eyewitness testimony for Vice. Now, Charlotte, you mentioned some contributing factors like lighting and weather, if a gun was involved. How about personal prejudices? What role did those play in misidentifying suspects?
Well, that is a huge factor. I mean, race is a big factor for misidentifications across the board, whether it's a white person trying to identify a culprit who is black or vice versa. And so these factors, these sort of environmental factors, are things that need to be presented to the jury. They aren't necessarily factors that can change. An eyewitness testimony is always going to be fallible and needs to be put in the proper context in the course of convicting someone. Mm-hmm. What can be changed, though, are what we call system variables, and that's how police collect the eyewitness testimony and then present it to the DA. And this is sort of how the idea of an eyewitness actually having their memory being contaminated or tainted, like any crime scene could potentially be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's research that really proves how, I mean, it's almost astonishing to read these studies, how vulnerable our memories are to suggestion. One of the first studies done by a psychologist named Elizabeth Loftus, who's sort of considered the mother of the science on eyewitness testimony, she found that just the way one frames a question can completely alter their memory of an event. Her example was looking at car crashes, and she showed hundreds of people video footage of car crashes, and then she asked them various questions on how fast were the cars going when they smashed together? How fast were the cars going when they hit each other? How fast were the cars going when they contacted each other? And each word elicited the memory of the eyewitness believed that the cars were going faster.
Mm-hmm.
In some instances, when she asked how fast were the cars going when they smashed, the witnesses fabricated a memory of broken glass, yeah. which didn't exist.
So, and even the way that police can shift their body posture, they can nod or smile or repeatedly show photographs of perpetrators even after they ID the one they believe is responsible. So that's human fallibility inside of a system. What are some of the proposed ways or practiced ways of mending that system?
Well, they're very simple, actually. The National Academy of Science has finally endorsed one method which advocates have advocated for 30 years, which is blind administration, meaning the officer conducting the photo lineup doesn't know who the suspect is and who the filler is. And this is very simple in most departments. It's easy to find an officer who doesn't know anything about the case. It's a little bit more complicated maybe in rural police departments or sheriff's departments where there might be only two people and both of them know who the suspect is. But generally is addressable still by using computers to show the photos, and the administrator doesn't see who is being looked at that time. There's also another suggestion that photos be shown sequentially instead of simultaneously, so that each photo is being tested to the witness's memory.
Mm-hmm. Instead, so you're not seeing six at a time, you're seeing one at a time.
Right. But there's really no reason for the investigator of a crime to be present during a photo lineup. The dynamic that develops between a witness and an investigator is you can't ignore the sort of power dynamic that's going on, and the witness, this desire to sort of, you know, please the investigator who's mm-hmm. trying to find the culprit.
Now, they have tried some of these procedural reforms in some places. Any data on how they're faring?
Places that have implemented the reforms say that they are very effective. There's a reduction in false identifications. I live in Oakland, California, and the Oakland Police Department reformed their practices a few years ago and said that it was completely a simple transition. The Santa Clara District's Attorney's Office was one of the first in California to implement the reform in their county, and they said that they have had no misidentification since the policy was implemented, and they had had some prior to that. Now what's really being pushed for is for the courts to adopt more rigorous screening processes. So Oregon actually did do that. They now have a process of screening eyewitness testimony to see whether or not there was suggestive tactics used. New Jersey in 2011 require that juries be instructed about the possible factors that influenced an eyewitness's recollection. So those are like more of the environmental factors that could have compromised their memory. But these reforms haven't been implemented universally. Unfortunately, what's happening right now is the sort of the trust in this sort of science is reaching courts more effectively. And the idea is that in cases that don't necessarily have the possibility for DNA to exonerate someone, this is another sort of science that lawyers and advocates are hoping can enter into the court process to review evidence that was faulty and that was used either intentionally or unintentionally to wrongfully convict someone. And unfortunately, not all jurisdictions are taking this seriously. And there's a big question as to why, considering that these reforms are simple. They don't require more overhead costs, more man or woman power. And one of the big pitches of them that the Innocence Project makes, for example, is that they tighten a case. They make a case more bulletproof for appeal. But the problem is that there's inertia in departments, but there's also the issue that if LA Police Department or Orange County Police Department reform their practices, they're also admitting that they've been doing something wrong for many years. And mm-hmm. right now there are many cases being appealed on this very basis, and that the attorney generals are fighting to maintain.
Charlotte Silver, independent journalist based in San Francisco, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find Charlotte's article, When Eyewitness Testimony Goes Terribly Wrong. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And now an historical tale of how our eyes, ears, and good sense can fail us. This story of the Sisters Fox, two adolescent girls who pranked their way into the center of America's 19th century spiritualism movement, comes to us from producer Nate DeMeo's podcast, The Memory Palace.
People said the house was haunted. And that was even before the two girls started talking to the dead. Kate Fox was 11. Her older sister Margaret was just about marrying age. She was 14, when they moved into the little house in the Nothing Village, 40 miles east of Rochester, New York. The girls had moved around a lot in their short lives, particularly in the last several years since their mom left their dad, when dad's drinking got to be too much. But now they were all together again. Their father seemed to be on the wagon for good this time, and he had found enough work shoeing horses to afford the rent in the little house in Hydesville. And he probably got a pretty good deal, what with the ghost and all. Their neighbors would talk about the traveling salesman who had been invited inside years before and was never heard from again. Never heard from, that is, until one night in March of 1848, when Mr. and Mrs. Fox first heard the strange sounds coming from somewhere behind the living room wall. Some nights it would sound like knocking, other nights like furniture moving, and it always seemed to be coming from the bedroom their daughter shared. Their parents would run in, hoping to catch them mid-prank, but when they opened the door, the girls would be fast asleep, and they didn't believe that their daughters could be tricking them. These were just girls. But they were tricking them. What started with a little tap-tapping on the walls, and tiptoeing back into bed, a hand over a mouth, a face in a pillow suppressing giggles, got more and more sophisticated as the nights went on. The sisters found that if they tied twine around an apple and tossed it across the room and quickly reeled it back in, the apple would skitter and skip along the floor and ricochet against the walls and furniture, and sound an awful lot like the restless wandering of a murdered door-to-door salesman. And on the night of March 31st, the Fox sisters revealed the latest in their growing repertoire of ghost simulation techniques. They called their mother into the room and told her that Kate had made contact with the spirit. She then snapped her fingers once, and they heard a tap in response. She snapped twice, and it tapped twice. The next night, the Foxes and all of their neighbors squeezed into the girls' candlelit room and waited for the spirit. At dawn, the audience slipped out of the house, convinced that they had just spent the night in the presence of a dead man and two girls with incredible powers. Mr. and Mrs. Fox were scared. Their daughters could not stay in that room anymore, so they sent them to live with their older sister Leah and her family. Leah was responsible. She'd look after them. But they found that the ghost followed the girls, and Leah found an opportunity. Before long, thanks to Leah's management, the Fox sisters were selling out a 400-seat theater in Rochester. By 1850, the then 13-year-old Kate and the 16-year-old Margaret were the toast of New York City. People would wait in line for hours to buy tickets to see them, so they could ask the sisters to ask the spirit for word of their dead loved ones on the other side. The rich and famous would come backstage to meet the girls. The newspaperman Horace Greeley took them under his wing and introduced them to private clients who would pay the sisters to introduce them to the departed. Greeley also introduced them to New York nightlife, to the wine and whiskey that had nearly drowned their alcoholic father and destroyed their family. And in the pages of his newspaper, Greeley introduced the Fox sisters to the world. There were other mediums. There had been many other people who claimed to speak to the dead. But there was something about these sisters that people believed. They were innocent, pretty girls. And they were very, very good at what they were doing. They kept submitting to the challenges of skeptics and kept passing every test. Even people who were utterly convinced that this was all a trick couldn't explain how they did it. And everyone else, they wanted to believe. This was the 1850s. People just died all the time from diseases and minor flus and infections, things that don't kill us now. Their family members, their friends, their kids would die in childbirth, in accidents at work and at home. Why wouldn't they want to believe that those they loved weren't gone, that those they lost could be found? Soon people were holding seances like we hold dinner parties. They were putting their faith in tarot readers and mystics. Some were just scam artists, others were just wrong. They were just seeing things that weren't there. But all of them together were changing America and the way its people thought about death and life. And this modern spiritualism, that was Greeley's phrase, stayed near the center of American life for decades to come, even as it left the sisters who started it all behind. On October 21st, 1888, a 54-year-old Margaret Fox sat on the stage of the New York Academy of Music in front of 2,000 paying customers. And she spoke to the dead, and then she showed the audience how she spoke to the dead. She had recently lost her appetite for the whole business, and she wanted to get back at her older sister Leah, whom she believed had been taking too big of a cut for years. So she told the people in the theater about how 40 years earlier, back in that little house in that nothing town, after a few nights of knocking and tiptoeing and tying strings to apples, she and her little sister realized that they could both crack their toes. They could just tense their feet, and there would be this sound. And they found that no one could tell that they were doing it. And so people actually believed they were talking to the dead. And that was fun. She told them how they were happy to find out that that weird little sound could carry all the way to the back of a big theater. She told them how later, when they were famous, and fancy people would come to their fancy apartment on 42nd Street, a customer could be sitting all the way across the room from Margaret or Kate, and one of them would crack her toe, and the customer would be sure she was just tapped on the shoulder. Because sounds are hard to place in space, and because you'll pretty much believe anything if you really want to believe it. She revealed all of that, but not everything. There were some things that were private, some things that maybe she didn't even understand herself. So she didn't tell them about how both she and her little sister started to unravel, not long after Horace Greeley introduced them to the world, and to worldly things like power and wealth and wine, things that had brought down people far better prepared for them than two kids from way upstate. She didn't tell them about how she and her sister struggled under the growing weight of their shared secret. She didn't talk about the times that Kate went further and further with her claims, moving beyond toe-crack conversations to moving furniture, to making ghostly hands appear out of thin air, at least in the minds of desperate believers. Or how she couldn't be sure how much her increasingly erratic sister believed her own nonsense. And that night in the theater, at the age of 54, she certainly didn't tell them about the time she tested her own belief. In 1852, the fame and money and parties brought a man named Elijah Kent Kane to one of her seances. She was 18, he was 32, and handsome, and a celebrated Arctic explorer. So she fell in love with him. And he loved her, but he didn't love her profession. He was Catholic, and his family was very Catholic. And there was no way they were going to approve a union between their God-fearing son and this godless woman who was spreading blasphemy. So she gave it up, and she and Kane began an affair. And they were happy for a few years. And she was sure a marriage proposal would come any day, until the scurvy Kane had been fighting for years finally killed him in 1857. Margaret didn't tell the audience how she broke down one night, despondent and alone, and tried to contact her dead love, how she tried to do for real what she had spent the last decade pretending to do. She didn't tell them how she called out to him, and how he didn't call back, and how she sat in the dark, knowing that he never would, and knowing that she would never be able to feel the comfort that the people who paid to see the sisters felt when they heard that their loved ones were at peace, or that they had been forgiven, or that they were always the one, of course they were, or that they would never be forgotten. Kate and Margaret Fox weren't forgotten, but at the times of their deaths, they weren't remembered fondly. Each died poor, neither living to see 50. The people who still clung to spiritualism were glad to see them go, and the people who never believed, they were too. Now, there's a postscript here that really can't be resisted, and you can do with it what you will. In 1904, they tore down that little house in that nothing town, and inside one of the walls, near what had been the girls' room, they found the skeleton of a man believed to be a traveling salesman, who appeared to have been murdered a few years before the Fox family moved in.
And that story came to us from Nate DeMeo's podcast, The Memory Palace. You'll find a link to listen to it again at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, thank you so much for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe. That's at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.